Good evening. It's Tuesday, about 9 p.m. And you know what that means. I'm sitting down in my basement, getting ready to record another episode of Death Mysteries. So tonight, I want to talk about two people that I knew growing up in Santa Rosa, California, and they're both people who committed horrific crimes, and they were close to me. They were friends of mine. They are people that I knew very well. And before I get to those cases, I would like to give you guys an update on the situation here in Southern Oregon in Josephine County. I think I've uncovered a few connections that nobody else is putting together yet. In my last episode, Limited Resources, we spoke of Sherry Wellwood. And during our investigation of that case, it has come to my attention that Angela Slover actually disappeared from the Dollar General store on Williams Highway in Murphy, very close to the Spencer Creek access road where Sherry Wellwood's car was found. And I've also discovered a third missing woman named Mindy Marie Gates. Mindy went missing on June 28th of 2020. She's a 40-year-old female, and she is roughly, 160, 180 pounds. She's got brown hair, and she went missing from the very small community of Murphy. That is the key, the location where all three of these women have gone missing in very recent history. The one thing I'd like to say about Murphy is that it is basically a strip of highway called the Williams Highway that runs through there, and it's got a Dollar General, it's got a hardware store and a few other small businesses, there is a high school out there, and there are a lot of homes, but it is not even really a small town, I would say. It's more of a community. It's definitely unincorporated. So the connection that I'm drawing between these three cases is the very small community of Murphy, more specifically the Dollar General in Murphy on Williams Highway. We know that Mindy Marie Gates went missing from that very area, and it's not a large area. It's a strip of highway, you know, a block or so long. We know that on September 20th, Angie Slover went missing from the Dollar General in Murphy. There is a high likelihood that Sherry Wellwood may have stopped in Murphy, maybe even at the Dollar General or at the hardware store there, on her way up that remote mountain pass, if she was driving. That's a big if. We don't have any hard evidence to go on in any of these cases, so we don't actually know where Mindy disappeared from. We know that Angie was seen at the Dollar General, and that is the last place that it was reported that she was physically seen by somebody. And Sherry Wellwood, we don't know, because all we found was her car and some belongings way up on a mountain pass overlooking Murphy. I'm just going to go over the dates again so everybody's clear about the timeline for these three women disappearing. Sherry Wellwood's car was found on December 19th of 2019 on a remote mountain pass outside of Murphy. Mindy Marie Gates was seen in Murphy on June 28th of 2020 and then vanished, probably somewhere really close to the Dollar General. And then we have Angie Slover, who was last seen in Murphy at the Dollar General on September 20th. So that is a very small window to have three women who are very similar in age. They don't quite look alike, but very similar in age, that disappeared from a very small community and nobody's looking for them, all in, you know, a 7-8 month period. This is bizarre. And I'm not maligning the Dollar General, it's just the only business there in town. But it does make me want to go down there and kind of sit around, maybe in my car undercover, and see who comes and goes. Maybe go down there on a Sunday and just see what locals are creeping around. See if anybody's looking a little suspicious at the old Dollar General, which is a great place to shop, I hear. I've actually never been in one. So part of my investigation when I go back out and kind of look for Sherry Wellwood's, I don't want to say remains, but go up and look for clues and maybe find her remains, we're going to stop at the Dollar General and poke around and maybe not ask questions, but kind of get a feel for the place. So I already gave you a description of Angie Slover and of Sherry Wellwood. We've talked about them in past episodes, but Mindy Marie Gates we don't want to use the past tense here. She is 40 years old, 189 pounds. She has a tattoo of two dolphins in the shape of a circle on her left wrist. Sounds like a cool tattoo. And she is, she's a brunette. She's a pretty lady. And gosh, we hope that she's found safe, and it could be that she went missing on her own. I did find that she has been arrested a number of times for drugs, and this is not, again, this is not victim shaming. This is not casting aspersions on somebody's character. These are just the facts, and she could be out there. I am very familiar with addiction, and people go on runs and they disappear from friends and family and then they pop back up. And I only bring this up because it's a possibility, and it's actually that would be a very good outcome for this case if she's just out there on a run. But we don't know that. She could have disappeared because somebody made her disappear, and that would be a very bad outcome. Anyway, if you have any information about this case, you can call the Grants Pass Public Safety Department at 541-474-5123. Okay, so I would just like to say that Death Mysteries is a different type of true crime podcast. Not only in that we go and we investigate crime scenes and we actively look for people who are missing, and we actively look at the places where horrific crimes have occurred and try to get a sense and a feel for some of these events and give you some crimeogenic introspection. That was really hard to say. But one of the other things that we do differently is I don't just bring you a case that I know nothing about and then wrap up the episode, never to talk about it again. I know Crime Junkies does updates and a few other podcasts do updates on the cases that they cover occasionally, but the cases that I'm covering here are ongoing, they are current, and they are not resolved. And I want to talk about Fauna Frey. I think I was saying her name wrong when I was saying Fauna Frey. I believe it's Fauna Frey. It's F-R-E-Y. And her first name is Fauna, F-A-U-N-A. And this case has involved a lot of people. It has involved a lot of resources from the family and a little bit of resources from law enforcement, but not as much as the family would like, and not as many resources are being spent on it as the community would like. and there is an open campaign to basically urge the police to process the evidence that was found. I mean, we literally have a Jeep that Fauna was driving, or possibly somebody else was driving, that was abandoned on a dirt road outside of Galice in the middle of nowhere in a spot that Fauna would not have gone to. We actually have bloody socks that were found 40 yards from this Jeep that have not been processed by the police. In fact, they aren't even considering this a crime scene yet. They're considering it a missing person. And what I know from reading what the family has written about this, and basically looking at Fauna Frey, it's a Facebook group called Help Us Find Fauna Frey. And I have been reading about this and interacting with the family, as have thousands of other people. And this is how we get resources pulled together to actually find people. I don't know if I'm going on a tangent there, but I would just like to say that they were able to bring in a number of groups of people with search dogs this last weekend, and they were able to spend a lot of time up in the mountains where her car was found. And the fresh perspective from the search and rescue teams that come from Idaho and elsewhere, at both professional law enforcement and retired law enforcement, and volunteers who are really good at this and have been doing it a long time, a fresh perspective on where her car was found is, now we do not believe that Fauna brought her car up there. We believe that somebody else did. And this is not good news. Gosh, in a case like this, there is not a lot of good news. But in my investigation, basically looking at some other unsolved homicides and disappeared people in this exact same area. I mean, it's like Murphy, but it's north of Grants Pass instead of south of Grants Pass. It's remote. It's got a lot of roads. People don't travel much. It's got a lot of dirt roads, and it is for locals. It is not a place where tourists go. There are miles, miles and miles of dirt roads. They go off, sometimes they dead end, sometimes they come back to each other, sometimes they become very harrowing. You would need a Jeep or a dirt bike to get over them. But that's besides the point. These are places that people don't generally go to unless they know about them. And I found a guy named Kenneth Greth who disappeared back in 2002. And 9 years later, his car was found pushed down an embankment out near where Fauna's car was found. They have never found Kenneth. And that's another case I may bring up at another time. I actually have done a little reading on that. And the only answers that were actually discovered in that case weren't from the police. They were from Kenneth's father, who went ahead and hired a private investigator and found out that his son was, well, there were rumors that he was either running from the law because he thought he had a warrant, or that people had killed him. And I'm leaning towards people had killed him and dumped his car out there. Basically, I'm not saying that Fauna has been the victim of a crime. We don't have evidence of that, but, and you know, we don't want to say that before we have evidence, but bloody socks and a car that was her Jeep that was dumped in an area where she wouldn't have known to go to, this is really concerning. And if I was law enforcement, I would probably switch gears and say, this deserves a lot more resources. This deserves our full attention. And Fauna's family and friends, who are basically putting their own money and their own time and their own energies, I mean, not that they shouldn't, but a lot of time, effort, money, energy into this case, into finding Fauna. They have captured the hearts of the community. They've captured my heart. And I really feel for these people. Just like Michael Bryson, who we were talking about in our last episode briefly. He's been missing a while, and he's got many, many hundreds and thousands of people pulling together and spending a lot of hours out in the woods looking for him. Not everybody has that. And I'm saying this because nobody's looking for Angie Slover, and nobody's looking for Mindy Marie Gates, and nobody's looking for Sherry Wellwood. And what's the difference? Their families maybe don't have the money or the time and the resources to go out there and and push a really hard court, hard court press to find their daughter, their girlfriend, their sister, their niece. These people have relationships. These people are real people who've gone missing. These people deserve to have resources put into finding them. And I just think it's a shame that we don't have the type of manpower and money to put professional law enforcement onto these cases and to actually have people trained. We do have search and rescue here. It's a big deal. But most of the search and rescue efforts, we know who we're looking for. We don't think that they just disappeared into thin air. Generally, it's a water accident, or we know they are lost hiking in the woods because they went out hiking and for whatever reason, they didn't return by nighttime or something. Most people are found. I was really interested in how many people were missing in the county I used to live in and grew up in Santa Rosa, California. And there's really not any outstanding missing person cases there. Not like there are here. We don't have 5, 6, 7 people going missing in the last year in Sonoma County and not being found. I looked in Marin County, and that's another place where I used to live, used to frequent. I'm very familiar with Marin County, California. And I thought, how many missing people had just vanished into thin air in Marin County? And when I went to the Marin County Sheriff's website and I looked at their current list of missing people, I started clicking on their names, and guess what? Each and every one of them either went out on a boat and never came back, or their car was found parked on the Golden Gate Bridge mid-span and they were nowhere to be found. So these aren't really missing people like we have up here. These are people who committed suicide or died accidentally by drowning. Every single one of them, except for one man that I found out in Inverness, California, who had vanished from his home. And that one is kind of mysterious, but only one case. And that is a county with a lot more people, and it's a lot more urban than here. And it does have dirt roads, and it does have trails and places you can get lost. But we've got a lot. My point is, we have a lot of people going missing here, and it's unacceptable, and it needs people's attention, and we need to really be talking about this. I hope I didn't go on too much of a tangent, guys. Thank you for listening. Maybe I got a little intense there, but this is something I really care about, and I'm really trying to put a lot of information into this episode and not make it go too long and to keep your interest. So as I had spoke of at the very beginning of this episode, I want to talk about two people I knew back when I was growing up that committed horrific crimes. This is going to be a little bit difficult for me because I have a personal connection to these individuals. The first one I want to talk about was my friend Christopher Topper, Chris Topper. And we went to junior high school and high school together. We hung out together. We went over to each other's houses. We hung out after school. And we had the same group of friends. And we weren't best friends or anything like that, but we knew each other rather well. And I do have a little bit of insight into maybe what made him become a killer. And these are my own personal observations from knowing him for years. And these are the things that aren't really public record. And I will talk about them, and I will be very candid, and I mean no disrespect to his surviving family. And when I say surviving family, I mean his mother and his sister. And first, I'm going to go into the details of what happened back in 2004, and then I will talk a little bit about knowing Chris growing up. Chris was arrested in late 2003 and taken to jail. He was under the influence and he was combative with the police, and he actually spent a couple of months in jail over an incident. And this was not the first time he'd been to jail, but this may have been the longest, and he was not receiving the mental health treatment that he needed. He was treated as a criminal and put in jail instead of being properly evaluated and possibly hospitalized in a situation where he could have received treatment for what I believe was schizophrenia, which, as we know, a lot of individuals grow up and they don't really exhibit too many symptoms of schizophrenia until they get into their late teens and early 20s. And that is what happened with Chris. And his mom, to this day, is a mental health advocate. Chris had become increasingly violent and paranoid, and he thought people were out to get him. It's said that he was hallucinating, and it's said that he was not in his right mind. He even assaulted a jail guard when he was detained after being arrested, and that probably contributed to him being in jail about 60 days instead of maybe being released on his own recognizance or treated otherwise. On February 3rd of 2004, Chris's stepfather, Howard, had come home to meet Chris and his wife, Chris's mother, Cherie, and Chris's aunt to take him to a probation hearing. And that's how this was being handled. They were putting Chris on probation. They were using the justice system to treat mental illness. Well, as soon as they went into Chris's room, Chris grabbed a .22 caliber rifle and shot Howard in the head, killing him. He then turned the rifle on his mother and shot his mother 5 or 6 times, shattering her jaw, shattering her leg, causing some tremendously terrible injuries. And after that, Carolyn Day, who was Chris's aunt, she was to go to the probation hearing also, being a loving aunt and being a family member who wanted to support her nephew. She came through the front door, and Chris turned the rifle on her and shot her a couple of times, killing her almost instantly. And he thought he had killed his mother, but luckily she survived after spending many weeks in the hospital. Chris then walked out of the house with the rifle, leaving his mother for dead on the floor. She was able to call 911 and get help on the way. And before she lost consciousness, the ambulance and the police were to arrive on scene and to take her to the hospital, where she survived after 10 hours of surgery. And Chris, when he grabbed the rifle and he went outside, he knew the police were coming, they were on their way. He put the rifle to his head and he shot himself. And they tried to save his life, they tried to save everybody's lives that day, but Chris ended up dying from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The only person to survive that shooting, out of 4 people shot, was Cherie. And oh gosh, this is a rough case. I knew these people when I was a kid. So while Chris was in jail back in late 2003, he did receive a mental evaluation from a psychiatrist. He did not receive treatment, but he received an evaluation. And what they found when they talked to Chris was that he had become psychotic, that he had become very paranoid, that he had fits of rage, and that he was unable to recognize his family members for the people that they were. He had had a break with reality, which is extremely dangerous. And he was prone to delusions. He was prone to seeing things. He did not know what was going on anymore. And I feel that, and I think a lot of my audience members will agree with me, I feel that people that are mentally ill should not be put into the criminal justice system. And it's a great shame that we have made our police officers and we have made our justice system into a mental health system. That it just simply isn't right. And people have died from this and will continue to die from this. We know that Chris had been given some medication while he was in jail. I don't know what medications. His records were sealed, and a lot of people aren't going to be fans of me for saying this, but he was an extreme marijuana user, and the psychiatrist actually pinpointed his daily, basically hourly marijuana use, very heavy use, as having some link to his psychosis. And this has been seen over and over again amongst heavy marijuana users. We're not talking responsible users. We're talking people that use every day, all day long. That if you are predisposed to schizophrenia, there is a link between that schizophrenia ballooning and heavy marijuana use. So I don't want marijuana to be illegal or anything like that. I don't think it's the devil weed, but I do think it is a very powerful drug that can have some very powerful repercussions when used in excess. So it's important to note that Chris was released 4 days before the shooting. So if he had been forced to take some medication while he was in jail, it is likely that he was not taking that medication any longer once he was released. And it is not known if the judge who released him had even read the psychiatrist's reports about his delusions, about his paranoid, basically pre-onset or onset schizophrenia. It's unknown if anybody really knew what was going on with Chris when they released him to jail and decided to give him a probation hearing. Before I wrap up talking about my friend Chris, I just want to say some really nice things about him. I remember being a kid with Chris and hanging out, riding bikes, hanging out at the park, playing soccer and hacky sack, listening to music. He was always a really good guy. I never would have pegged him, and he wasn't. I never would have thought that he was capable of this kind of violence, especially when I was close with him and knew him. And I did meet his parents, both his stepfather, Howard, who was murdered, and I did meet his mom a number of times, and they were very nice people, and they loved Chris, and they supported him, and it's just really a heartbreaking shame. I will say a couple of things that I think may have contributed to this. When we were kids, I know that Chris had gotten into not just marijuana, but I knew that he liked to use inhalants, like glue sniffing and other inhalants like that. And I will say that the high school and junior high school I went to, there were a lot of drugs around, and a lot of people used a lot of drugs. And I'm not going to self-incriminate myself, but of course, as a teenager, I smoked some marijuana, I did that kind of stuff, I hung out with people who did that, and it was all fun and games, right? It's all fun and games until somebody gets killed. And I do want to say too, I remember an incident that I think may have changed Chris's life. When we were in high school, a couple of people, and I'm not going to say any names, but a couple of people attacked Chris with a shovel and a rake, and they beat him until he was unconscious and caused a massive head injury. And we do know that there is a link between head injuries and violent behavior. A lot of serial killers and a lot of people who commit heinous crimes are the victims themselves of a head injury when they are young. And I think, in my heart of hearts, I believe that this head injury, that this incident where he was beaten so badly with weapons, that this may have, I believe that this did have something to do with Chris's ultimate crime and ultimate taking of his own life. Chronic traumatic encephalitis, or encephaly, is a condition that we have come to recognize as a society as putting people at greater risk to committing violence. And one of the most famous cases in recent history is that of Aaron Hernandez, the football player, who ended up killing a number of people before ultimately taking his own life while he was imprisoned. And I, through my research and through listening to a lot of true crime podcasts and reading about other cases, I know that people who sustain either one or many times a series of head injuries, it changes their brain through chronic traumatic encephaly, and it makes them into a killer when they really aren't that in their core. It's a cause. It's brain damage. It is irreversible, and we may someday know how to treat this, but we don't yet. And I just would like to say that if you have sustained a traumatic brain injury, or you know somebody who has, that doesn't mean you're going to become a killer, but it does mean you're at greater risk to having violent outbursts. There is a link, and there's a lot of writing and a lot of studies about this. And if you want to know more, you can Google it. It's called CTE. The last case I am going to talk about tonight is another person that I knew when I was growing up, and he was a little bit older than us high school kids, and he was in his late 20s, and he would hang out with us at the park, and he would buy us beer, and he said some things that made me know that there was something going on with this guy beyond just wanting to hang out with teenagers and drink beer. Something that made me realize he might not be a nice person. I'm talking about a man named Henry Harper, who I knew for a number of years, and who ultimately turned out to be a serial rapist. And the types of crimes he committed were very violent, and they're the types of crimes we see people who go on to murder other people, who become serial predators, dare I say serial killers. These are the kind of crimes that they commit early on when they're ramping up. And we may not have the full scope of what crimes were committed by Henry, but we do know of two incidents that were very close together, at least two that were reported before his crime spree was cut short. And I will go into these two crimes. One in particular, you're probably going to be cheering at the end of the crime that gets him caught and the crime that puts him away to San Quentin prison. Before the crime that got Henry caught, he had raped a 75-year-old woman in her home in a neighborhood, one neighborhood over from where I lived when I was in high school. And the whole community was on edge. And there is reason to believe that he may have more victims that never came forward. But we do know that he committed a crime on February 5th when he broke into her house late at night, early morning hours, and he raped her. And he got away with it for a little while. But Henry could not contain himself, and I'll talk a little bit later about some things that he said that made me know that he was probably pretty dangerous around women. But first I'm going to go into the crime that got him caught, and I will elaborate a little bit on it. And like I said, you'll probably be cheering at the end of that segment. On February 11th of 1996, I was a senior in high school, and I knew Henry. I would see him every couple of days, if not more frequently, at the park across the street from my house. And he would hang out there with one of my friends, Beer Pat, as we called him, and a couple other people. And these are guys who were in their, you know, they would kind of live in the Matthew McConaughey, dazed and confused, perpetual teenager lifestyle, where they would hang out with us kids. You know, we were kids. We were seniors and juniors in high school. And, you know, we enjoyed having some guys in their 20s who would buy us some beer. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of difference between, you know, late teenagers and people in their 20s, especially when they're acting like kids, acting like teenagers, because maybe they never grew up. So the crime that got Henry Harper caught, this one made the news. This one got attention across the state. I don't know if it got a national attention, but this is a good story. in some ways and a tragic story in other ways. On February 11th, Henry Harper broke into a house. He climbed through the window of a bathroom, and it was the early morning hours, sometime between 2 and 3 in the morning, and he crept into the bedroom of a 12-year-old little girl, and he told her that he would kill her if she made any noise. And Henry Harper proceeded to rape this little girl and turn her into his victim. But that wouldn't be the end of the story. Her father awakened sometime during the night when Henry was in this girl's bedroom, and he went to the bathroom, probably the same bathroom that Henry Harper climbed in through that little window to gain access to the house, and he heard something in his daughter's room, and being a good father, he went to investigate, and when he opened the door, he saw Henry Harper on the bed raping his little daughter. And this man instantly started to fight with Henry, and I will say that Henry was not a small guy, nor was he a weak guy. He was an adult male who could take care of himself, who could fight. And so the struggle was on. Basically, this man, I believe he was 51 at the time, and I'm not going to use any names for these people. I believe in, you know, them being able to maintain their privacy over this. In fact, their names were never used in the news reports. But his father was 51 years old at the time, and the local rumor in my neighborhood, because people knew these people, this is where I grew up, was that he was a Hell's Angels member. So he was probably nothing to mess with either, but he was a little bit older than Henry. I think Henry was 30 years old at the time, and the fight was on, and Henry was getting the best of this man trying to protect his little baby girl from a monster who was raping her. So this courageous young girl, she went and found the only weapon she could find, and that would be a frying pan of all things. She came back in to the bedroom to help her dad fight this monster, this man, Henry Harper, and he spun around, and this 12-year-old girl hit him in the head so hard with a frying pan that it dented the pan. And I know that her sister and her mother had awakened at this time, and they had gotten 911 on the phone. And the fight was still going on. Henry would not give up. The whole family joined in trying to detain Henry Harper. And he was fighting tooth and nail to get away. You know, he didn't want to be caught. They grabbed a Pyrex pan, a Pyrex glass pan, and they broke that over his head. And Henry was still not subdued. And when the police got there, finally, Henry was beat up pretty badly by this family, but he was still fighting, and it took three officers to tackle him, pepper spray him, handcuff him, take him into safety, and to get him away from the family that he was victimizing and put him where he belonged in the Sonoma County Jail. And the news report of his arraignment made me chuckle a little bit, because it said that Henry Harper was in a wheelchair, and that he was so badly beaten, the injuries were apparent, and that he was having trouble functioning, and this is yet another head injury, and one he deserved. And it's obviously not a head injury that made him into a monster. He may have been born that way. I think this is probably a good time to bring up that when we were hanging out at least a couple of times at the park, he would make comments about little girls and women in the park. When I say little girls, I mean like 8 and 9 years old. And one time he turned to me and he said, would like a piece of that, about a little girl on the swings. And I looked at him and I thought, what the hell is wrong with you, dude? But I didn't say that, because I think I was 17, and you know, I think he was 28, 29, and a lot bigger than me. And you know, I'm not about to call him on his shit, but today I probably would. So I knew something wasn't right with this guy. So Henry Harper, ended up being prosecuted for these two rapes, and he ended up getting sent to San Quentin. And he lived about 10 more years. And I think he was probably in protective custody. Not quite sure what sentence he got. I think it was 30 to life for these violent crimes. And when he was in prison, I heard a rumor that he was assaulted numerous times and that he may even have died as a result of one of these attacks by a fellow prisoner. But I also heard that he may have died of cancer or something else like that at just about 40 years old while he was imprisoned. Regardless of what regardless of what happened inside San Quentin to cause Henry Harper to die, I can say that the world is probably a better place for this man having met his end and being put away in prison for the rest of his life so that he couldn't hurt anybody else, so he couldn't rape a 75-year-old woman again, so he couldn't rape a 12-year-old girl again. Who knows what other crimes he may have been responsible for. Another interesting fact about Henry Harper was that his dad was actually a probation officer in Sonoma County. He was one of the head probation officers, so he probably brought Henry up pretty good. I don't know about Henry's personal life that much, other than that he was married and had two children at the time of all of this, and I actually met his wife and his children before. He brought them to the park a couple of times to hang out with us, which I thought was kind of weird. So his dad was also the head of the Police Athletic League and was heavily involved in PAL football, and so he was a highly respected member of the community. Who knows why somebody goes bad? Sometimes they come from a really good family, and there's no reason other than that they're pre-programmed to rape or murder or kill. And I shouldn't say that that's necessarily the case, but something went wrong with Henry Harper, and he created victims, and he created havoc, and he got what he deserved. He died in prison only 10 years later, a young man at 40 years old. And I can only say that he created a number of victims, and I feel for his wife and his two children who had to grow up without their father in their lives, regardless of what kind of man he was, and had to endure the knowledge that their father, the husband, had raped these people, had raped this little girl and this elderly woman. And I feel for the rest of his family, his father, and everybody else who, when you commit a crime, is what I'm trying to say. If you commit a heinous crime, it's not just you who does the time. It's not just you who gets prosecuted. It's your family, too. It's your innocent family. It's people that have to live with the stigma of what you did, even when you go to prison. Maybe that doesn't really matter to people like Henry Harper and some of the other monsters that we talk about on these true crime podcasts, but it matters to me. I feel for those people. I wouldn't pass any judgment on somebody just for having a family member that's capable of this kind of violence and disgusting depravity. I could use all kinds of adjectives, but I think my audience is on board with that, you know, this is the kind of abnormal behavior that really puts a damper on our society. Damper, that's not strong enough language. This is the kind of stuff that leads to missing people, to unsolved homicides, to strings of burglaries and rapes and other crimes. Not everybody is out there trying to do their best to help other people in society. And we've got to be wary. And we've got to be careful about who our friends are. And if somebody you know makes a comment that you find so off-putting that you remember it 25 years later, that you look at that person and you think, there's something seriously wrong with that person, you might want to do something about it. And I wish I had at the time. I don't know what I could have done. But in the future, if somebody says something like that to me, it's not just going to get filed away and ignored in my brain. I'm going to do something about it. And I encourage my audience to think the same way. If you think something's not right, there's probably something that isn't right. All right, so that is all I really wanted to talk about tonight. I will be coming back with more updates about the 5 missing women in my area that I've talked about, that I think there's a connection between 3 of them at least. And I will come back, and next week I actually have another case from the Pacific Northwest that ended up crossing 3 states, and the ultimate conclusion to that case was in Mendocino County, another place I know and love, and I kind of grew up there a little bit. It was my home away from home when I lived in California, and it's an interesting case that we'll probably dedicate a full episode to, and it is a tragedy. It's complex, and there's actually quite a bit out there for me to talk about. And I'm just going to leave it at that. It's a death mystery. Until next time, I really appreciate my audience. Thank you for listening. And if you like what I do here, don't hesitate to turn somebody else onto my podcast. And also don't hesitate to reach out to me and give me some feedback, a little bit of criticism, whatever. If I could do it better, I definitely want to, because I enjoy doing this. The one bit of criticism that I really appreciate that I got lately is a couple of my earlier podcasts. If you're listening to them in headphones, the music is a little bit louder than I would have liked it to be. And I didn't make these listening to the podcast in headphones. I made them playing them back with a little speaker, a little Bose speaker. So I couldn't quite tell the level of the music and how jarring it would be to some people. Some people found it to be fine. But again, any type of criticism, content related, engineering related, sound engineering related, whatever, don't hesitate to reach out to me. You can email me at deathmysteriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Kingman Bond Graham. I'm on Facebook. I do a lot of other non-death mysteries related stuff. You can usually find me on the mushroom boards. All right, so it's actually the stroke of midnight. I'm done a little bit early this time. So have a beautiful, beautiful evening, and watch your back, my friends.